This is the second tape of the interview with Dr. Maury Crane, and when the last tape ended, we were talking about the Vince Boyce Library and your production on FDR that you did. How would you describe the collections at the time when you took over in terms of...
Well, any library collection, special library collection, is a reflection of the collector. Mm-hmm. Mine's very simple. I took in things that I could get free. Bob wanted to make it seem more impressive than it was, and so he never sourced things. He would never say, this comes off a Columbia record, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. He would never say, this comes off Edward R. Murrow. He would take these separately, and so it was all... He wanted it, as all collectors do, to make theirs look like a unique and marvelous collection. It was very good, and the fact that it was cataloged was fine. What I did is I found people who wanted to give away their collections.
Who were some of these people?
Lansing Community College went to a different format. I got their entire audiovisual library. The Wingspread Foundation, this is in Racine, Wisconsin, and they have one or two meetings, scholarly meetings a year. If Johnson's Wax sold nothing but Raid, it would be one of the richest private corporations. It's owned by the family. The president of the Wingspread Foundation later became Bill Boyd. Bill Boyd, PhD in history from the University of Pennsylvania, was my next door neighbor in the flat tops, in the temporary veterans housing mm-hmm. here at Michigan State. And we were very good friends. He went off to be the dean at Alma, ran the Honors College at Ohio State, became the president of Central Michigan University, at which time I would come up and give addresses kind of frequently. Then he went off and became the president of the University of Oregon. Then he went to the Johnson's Wax Foundation, and he married Karen Johnson. So there he is, married into the family that owns one of the richest businesses in the world. And they've got this Wingspread Foundation. And I came up and did a couple of things, shows like I used to do with J.P. McCarthy. And he gave me the entire canon. This so excited the Stanley Toole people who run the Stanley Foundation in Muscatine, Iowa, that they said, can we give you our entire collection? And then other people gave us their collections. There was a man named Tony Janik. Tony Janik was the chief recording engineer for Columbia Records. But he had a business on the side in which he did a clipping service for famous people, not of newspapers, but things that were on radio and television. And he had six television stations in the New York area, WABC, WNBC, WCBS, Metro Media, WNYC, and something else, maybe the PBS station. And he had six radio stations, and he had these things running all day, and he would come home at night, and he had, mainly his wife, and they... would send off to people like Golda Meir and O.J. Simpson and Henry Kissinger subscribers. And they could get subscribers. They would send people things. Nixon became a subscriber. See what people were saying. Tony wanted to retire. He wanted to sell his collection for a couple $1 million. He called me up. I said... we don't have that kind of money, but I'll give you the addresses of the other people who do this. They all didn't have that kind of money, too. And we talked. Well, Tony had been a corporal working for Bob Vincent in his recording studio during the war, the V-Disc studio. We danced around each other until we both felt at ease talking about Bob's eccentricities. And then we just became very, very good friends. And finally he says, if you'll send a truck down here, you can have it. So they evaluated it at $500,000. And if you go into the Kellogg Center, where they got that plaque on the wall of major donors to the university, mm-hmm. Tony is one of them. Mm-hmm. And he sent me so many things that if that stuff had gone to Bailey School, they'd have the biggest voice library in the world. It more than doubled our collection.
It doubled. What year was it?
This was in 81. Mm-hmm. Mike Worf gave us all of his originals. He got tax credit for it, though. And so he's a donor to the university. He called me up when we were going to the Rose Bowl. He says, I'm getting 4 tickets to the Rose Bowl. He says, what are you? I said, fine, I'll see you when we get there.
And he was at WJR?
He was at WJR. And, Bob Reynolds was at JR. And JP and something W. Smith was there. And I got to go there with different people at different times. Bob Reynolds would always interview me at the Michigan State football game when it was here. But that was a good source to have. We have people in Germany and England who want our stuff. Most of my German stuff, Bob had a budget to buy, and I really didn't. He bought from Pelletier. I have 2 trading friends, one in Berlin and one in Frankfurt. I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure it's Frankfurt now. But whatever it is, they want Buffalo Bill and I want Hermann Göring, and this is a good thing to have. This is the same thing's true with my guys in London, my friends in Paris. The guys in France are very good. I used to deal with the Phonotech Nationale, a lady named Francine Bluck. But I've got 2 guys who came to visit, and they visited this country. I may have told you this. They visited New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and East Lansing, and Washington, D.C. And they sent me. I had the complete Lenin, except for the one that Stalin ordered destroyed, that couldn't get out of Russia. And that was when Lenin condemned anti-Semitism, and Stalin really didn't feel like condemning anti-Semitism. This was the impossible Lenin, and they had just picked it up in Bucharest. They had just picked it up, and I said I needed that. Well, they needed Gene Autry or some damn thing. And so this is what happened. This is a great thing. I don't know how legal any of this is. We are trading baseball cards. We're trading bubblegum cards. Only, as you know, we're trading Xeroxes of bubblegum cards, except that a Xerox of a bubblegum card or a Xerox of the Magna Carta or a Xerox of the Declaration of Independence is not the same thing, but a tape of a tape is a tape. I got a lot of stuff from a lot of different people. And this was my skill. I was making bricks without straw. The library, shortly after I got there, evidently wasn't interested at all. They spend more. My good friend, Randy Scott, spends more in 3 months on comic books than I spent in 26 years on voices. Mm-hmm. And he does it every 3 months. That's because nobody gives you comic books free. It's not, mm-hmm. it's not because I'm virtuous and he's avaricious. You got to buy comic books. Mm-hmm. You get comic books free, but you mainly buy them.
And he's a librarian in the special collections?
He's the comic book man. Mm-hmm. And you know, Michigan State is that kind of library, which has the best library of comic books, voices, and turf grass. That's what we've got. I don't think we can beat Ann Arbor in anything else. But we can beat them in things that they don't want. That's what we can beat them in.
You mentioned the some of the tapes that you had were, or the recordings were tapes of tapes of tapes.
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about some of the technology, how that changed, and maybe how it influenced, you were dealing mostly in cassette tapes or reel-to-reel tapes?
Or open reel.
Open
we
reel.
Saved
okay.
everything in open reel. And the predictions of when open reel would fall apart keep changing because...
They're increasing. So.
Yeah, the time increases. Well, now they're doing they're digitizing everything. They've got money to digitize the collection. And, you know, they got a grant. And they may get the grant repeated, although I can't say that. I just don't know. Mm-hmm. To put the collection online. What they have to worry about putting the collection online is copyright. Mm-hmm. What you try to do is wait till somebody else gets sued and there's a precedent. What they do is they're very constipated about this. They want to be exceptionally safe. Mm-hmm. And so they're operating very, very slowly. The Voice Library was under me, free, fast, and friendly. Somebody calls and wants Katharine Hepburn, and I've got six Katharine Hepburns, and I said, I'll get them out to you this afternoon. There's now a copyright officer. And he checks on these things. If we have six, there's no chance a person could get more than one or two. It used to be free. I said about free. They now charge $20 a voice, not a tape, but a voice. So if she wants six, it's $120. It used to be free, and she got it by return mail. We are not friendly. Because the library is now run by guys who went to library school where they have a three-semester course in how to say no to legitimate requests, you know. This is what they do. They are anal retentives, you know. So it's a different world. I didn't mean for everything to change when I left. But everything changed when I left. I got a call yesterday from a lady at the University of Virginia. They're doing a show on integrating the schools in Virginia, the public schools. She says, I can't find anything. I said, here's what you do. Wilbur Brookover had a project integrating the schools in Prince Edward County. It was Bob Green's dissertation. You punch up the Voice Library, and you punch up Brookover, or punch up Green, or punch up Virginia integration, and you get it. Then I said, I don't work there anymore, so you're going to have to go through a copyright person. But this isn't so bad, because I think Bob is currently visiting campus, and Wilbur lives in town, and once or twice a year he goes down to Virginia to check on how things are going. John Shaw is one of the great guys in this world, but he doesn't know this. You know, you don't know it unless you know it.
And you knew the collection.
And I knew the collection. Peter Berg is in charge of the collection, but he's in charge of 17 other things, you know, including you know, this Great Lakes thing that Wendy Wilkins is involved in, you know. Is there such a thing as a Great Lakes culture? All you got to do is have a course in it, and yes, you know. Of course, we say in the jazz world, as soon as you teach a course in something, it's dead, you know. It means you assume it's over. You cannot write a doctoral dissertation at Cambridge University, Oxford or the Sorbonne either, but Cambridge is the one I know, on a living author. So that when E.M. Forster dies or Ernest Hemingway dies, there's this flood of dissertations coming in. They've been written. But the assumption is that with his dying breath, a guy can say, I want you to know that I copied all of this from George Eliot, you know. But we teach courses in living. We did. Michigan State teach courses in anything, you know. There was a man named Tom Hamilton here, my dear friend Tom Hamilton, and somebody at a faculty meeting back when they could get the entire faculty into the music auditorium, the entire Senate, said, how would you differentiate Michigan State from a school like, say, Harvard? Did I tell you this story?
No.
And Tom, who was the ultimate politician, he was brilliant and he was crooked. You know, Tom said, I find Michigan State University and Harvard University to be on the opposite poles of an optimism-pessimism continuum regarding the number and variety of courses that can be taught successfully at the university level. And we're sitting in that meeting and said, son of a gun, we just beat Harvard. You know, because optimism's always a good word. You know, it's morning in America. An optimism about what you can teach for college credit. And that's true. Whorehouse management, whatever we teach. You know. I don't know how I got to that, but we teach things that aren't over yet, you know. Probably a good thing.
That popular culture, obviously Russ Nye was very influential in starting. How were you involved in
well,
that besides
Russ
your teaching?
Well, Russ started both American Studies and popular culture. Mm-hmm. Russ believed. You know, I try to get the English department to teach a course called American Literature in Translation, because American literature is all in English, mm-hmm. whereas American literature should be a geographical thing, and it should be in Spanish and Polish and Yiddish and Italian, you know. Mm-hmm. And it would be a great course, a course called American Literature in Translation. I didn't have time. By the time I got in the English department, I was running the voice library. I just didn't have time. They would have given me a year off, but the library wouldn't give me a year off to work up such a course. But this was an idea. Russ was just full of ideas. When he came here, American literature, not ATL, American literature was low-class stuff, you know. The more British it sounded, Henry James, the more you taught it, you know. The less British it sounded, Fenimore Cooper, although he sounded like Sir Walter Scott in some ways, the less, you know. But he persevered, and in order to make it valuable, he really had to teach sociology of literature. You really have to do that. It's important. You know, we said when I taught the ancient world that you study Greek politics in order to understand their literature. You study Roman literature in order to understand their politics. You know, you study the thing that helps you. We study the life of Shakespeare in the hope that it'll throw some light on these. It shows damn little light. Because we don't know much about Shakespeare. We know a lot about the plays. But Russ was an amazing man. He knew how good he was. He just didn't want to talk about it. I said at his funeral, which was very small, it was by invitation, because Russ had been sick for 9 years, and Kay decided to have nobody come to that funeral who hadn't visited him in that time. And not all of them. I said Russ was a great man and a good man. But his goodness was in the center of the stage in front, and his greatness was way back in the back. He used his greatness in service of his goodness. When you couldn't get jobs for PhDs in English from Princeton, you know, he was getting Michigan State PhDs jobs at great universities. Not all of them, but some. He used his name to get his people published, you know. I went to MLA conventions with Russ. We frequently roomed together. And a couple of evenings, he says, I'll see you later. He was taking all the MSU graduate students out to a meal at a great restaurant. It's once in Milwaukee, once in Chicago. He knew what his reputation was, but he didn't make much fuss about it. He used it, and he used it to build up the English department, which is now not a very great department. It is not a very great department. But old men die, and they're replaced by young men, you know, and they may be great someday, but they haven't done it yet. They haven't done it yet. And Russ made everybody around him smart. He did this with his students. In the last 9 years of his life, I used to take him for a ride every Sunday in the automobile. Marshall McLuhan tells you this. Russ couldn't walk. He was incontinent. He couldn't read. He couldn't write. But while I was driving the car, I couldn't walk. And I couldn't read, and I couldn't write. And I always had to go to the bathroom, you know. And I would say, who was the shortstop for the St. Louis Browns in 1936? And that was good for 2 hours, you know. Well, what were the true influences on Charles Brockden Brown, you know? I'm not smart, but I'm glib, you know, and I could think of these things. He was a most remarkable man. I made a vow never to turn a profit on Russ Nye, never to get anything from him. He was the world's greatest giver. When we used to go out to Iowa, he was the fastest gun in the West picking up a check. And I decided, when I was seeing him when he was ill, and people didn't visit him because he was such an ugly sight, you know, he was...
Crippled. He had memories of how he was.
Yeah, and maybe from... And he would say, someone says, are you Russell Nye? He said, I used to be. But he was going to give me his jazz record collection. And it's a great collection. And Kay called me up and said, when are you going to come over and pick up the collection? And I said, Kay, if you give that to Bowling Green University, they will give you credit for $1 a record. And it's a couple of $100. I'm not allowed to give you credit at all. I'm not allowed. I like that collection and I want that collection, but Bill Shirk will send a truck up tomorrow if you call him. And he did. Bill Shirk not only has funding behind him. Of course, it didn't cost him anything in funding, he just gave him credit. But Bill Shirk is the most educated garbage man in the world, you know. You've been down to that library. He's got this collection of hubcaps, you know. It's the biggest hubcap library in America. But I had this personal thing with Russ. I didn't want him ever to get me a job. I didn't want him ever to do anything because I had this kind of pure love for him. And Peter knows about it, and Kay knows about it, and that's enough. Vic Howard thought I should continue to visit because Kay liked to see me. But the truth of the matter is, I went there as kind of a parish call, as kind of a faith-based therapy, you know.
Did you collect any of his materials at the Voice Library? Are there any?
I've got him speaking. Yeah,
you've got him.
I've got him speaking. And when I taught oral history, I always when I taught popular culture, I always played Russ as the founder. I wanted to use The Unembarrassed Muse in my course, but it's out of print. But Kay took me down to the basement and gave me every copy she had. So I've got about 28 copies of The Unembarrassed Muse. And it's outdated. The thing about popular culture is there's no hip hop in there now. Popular culture doesn't have to be good. It doesn't say good culture. It says popular culture. And it does tell us who we are. If I were teaching popular culture this year, I would teach the XFL, which is a combination of the NFL, the World Wrestling Foundation, and the Jerry Springer Show. This is what it is. It's gratuitous ugliness, which is where we're going.
The Voice Library and students, how did students use, how did they fit into the mission at all? Did they?
Well, MSU students theoretically, this university is here to serve the students. And you get freshmen, and you know these kids have been going to grade school and junior high and high school all their lives, and their concept of what a university is a place where people are paid to teach them. And the better they teach them, the more famous they are as professors. And they soon discover, if a guy's a really famous professor, he's in Vienna, you know. And he's moderately famous, he's in Washington, and he's kind of famous, he's in the stacks, you know. What they discover is this university isn't set up to teach them. I was reading a book the other day about flax. We studied in junior high and high school that the main product, we always listed flax. Belgium has flax, and France has flax. Iowa has flax, everybody has flax. Nobody's ever seen flax. Flax is this little thing you make linen out of. But a kid wants to get an A on a geography paper. All through school, you gotta mention flax. This is flax! You leave out flax and you get the best you can get is an A minus. Where's the flax, says the teacher. Kids have a funny idea what teaching is about. They think, "Why, he's a great teacher. Why didn't he ever win the teacher award?" Because he doesn't bring in money, that's why. The kids are theoretically the reason for the Voice Library. But we get our fame among librarians because Bryant Gumbel talks about us and Garrison Keillor talks about us. And we're on trailers for movies, you know. And the more famous people who use you, the more they like you. In the library, poor librarians, you know, feel that they're really professors, you know, and you're famous out of town. People know all about you in Iowa City and Tuscaloosa, you know. Nobody knows who you are these days.
How did Garrison Keillor use the collection?
Oh, they changed the name of the theater in St. Paul to the F. Scott Fitzgerald Theater. This was about 6 years ago.
From the World, was it? Or
whatever the theater was called, it became the F. Scott Fitzgerald Theater. Only one person had the voice of Scott Fitzgerald. That was us.
Oh, really?
A friend of mine dug it up, a friend of mine in San Diego. He had gone into one of these booths, 25-cent record your voice booths, and made for Sheila Graham, he was reciting some romantic poet. I think it's Byron. And then he screws up and he says, "Oh shit," he says, you know. And he made this and he gave it to her and it was in her estate and some got it. This friend of mine who's a psychiatrist got it at a hawk shop and sent it to me. It's the voice of Scott Fitzgerald. It's a great voice. He's reciting poetry that he'd memorized at Princeton or in prep school in Minnesota. And I sent it off to Garrison Keillor, and he said, "We want to thank those wonderful people at the University of Michigan."
Oh,
because
no.
When anything good comes out of the state, they assume it's from Ann Arbor. Why the hell would those cowboys, you know, why would Michigan say, why would they have that? There was a picture of me on the Brian Gumbel show when he was on NBC, and they said, Ann Arbor. This is what they do because this isn't a serious place. This is a place where guys like you and me teach, you know. This is a place for guys who are chasing commas through Coriolanus, you know. But people, they did a Nova show. We had the only voice of Sigmund Freud in English that they could get. Mm-hmm. A lot of Freud in German. A lot of Einstein in German. But we wind up, I wound up.